Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always forget what we need to say next. Okay, let's see. Disclaimer, disclosure. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of a riveting show, riveting economic show, a show about economic riveting, whatever it is that this thing is. It is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. It's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. That's our regulator of choice, or I don't know, regulator of law.
They chose us, I believe.
Yeah,
it wasn't the other way around.
By law, we are regulated by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission.
No, I think we're regulated by law, not by law regulated.
Yeah, the law.
Wait a minute.
The law states that they're going to regulate us because we have enough money.
Regulatorily speaking.
Right. And let's see, what else? Whatever we say on this radio program is educational and it should not be construed to be investment advice. The information we present is from sources we believe to be reliable, but is not warranted or guaranteed. Close cover before striking.
I'm going to jump in and explain one of those, because we say all these and we kind of make a joke out of it every week, but we really don't give investment advice on the air for a really good reason, because you're not all the same people. Well, maybe there's only
Wait
one
a
listener.
Minute. There's
there
only
could
one
be only
listener.
One listener. If there's only one listener, then you are all the same person. But in the event that you are not all the same person, if we give advice to one of you and the other one it's completely inappropriate for, follows on that, it can hurt you. It can hurt us. It can hurt everybody.
That and diagnosis without prescription
without
diagnosis
is
malpractice.
Yes.
And since we don't know everything there is to know about you, the NSA does, but we don't.
Right.
Then giving you advice would be inappropriate. So
the intent here is to give you at least some degree of education on what's going on in the economy, on why things are happening the way they are, so that you can make the decision on whether or not you need to get advice for yourself or whether or not you're qualified to advise yourself. And that's one of those areas that sometimes people come to us and I say, you don't need our help. I think you could probably get some convenience out of using our help and save some time, but you're doing all right. That's not the normal refrain if you take money to a salesperson. So just keep that in mind. We're not salespeople.
We're not?
Well, I guess we sell advice, but not on the air.
Right.
On the air, we just talk a lot.
Yeah, something like that.
So what happened this week?
You really think something happened this week?
Yeah, I came back from Colorado, which was fantastic. I think that the market should experience Colorado for a little bit and head up into the Rockies and relax.
Let's see. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which we don't normally talk about, went past the 22,000 mark, and it hit new highs for 8 days in a row, which sounds really impressive until you realize it isn't. And, you know, the year-to-date, it's up 11.79%. This week, it was up 1.2%. But let's drop down to reality. And the reality is the S&P 500, which is a much bigger sample of the stock market, year-to-date is up 10.63, not that much different. But this week, it was up 0.19%. Why? Well, we've often said the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not a very accurate measure of what's going on in the market. And man, was that ever true. Last week, the Dow was kicked upward by one of its higher-priced stocks, Boeing. And this week, Dow was kicked up above 22,000 by one stock, Apple. Apple reported about a 15% rise in the sales of their iPhones and iPads and so on that nobody expected that we could find, except maybe Tim Cook. And as a result, the Dow Jones Industrial Average got kicked up to a record high 8 days in a row and crossed the magic 22,000 mark. You know, the backside of that is, and I think it's important, is we could remember when the Dow, at least I can remember, when the Dow crossed 1,000 for the last time on the way up. Actually, in 1973, it crossed 1,000 the first time, and then it plunged. But the last time was 9 years later, 1982, and I can clearly remember we literally had a celebration when it went from 1,000 to 2,000. I mean, it had doubled at 2,000.
Yeah, I have the Wall Street Journal with the front page of it crossing the 5,000 mark.
Yeah, and that was
That was a big deal.
Right, and now we're at 22,000. And if back then we had said the Dow will go to 22,000 ever, people would have said we were crazy. And there was a book came out, Dow 35,000. And it's going to, you know, I'm quite confident the Dow will get to 35,000. As a matter of fact, if they get enough fast-growing large stocks in there, it could get to there very quickly. But the reality is the stock market really hasn't done much of anything except rise very slightly almost every week, except for the few weeks it fell very slightly. The big news is not that the Dow is up above 22,000. It's that the S&P 500 didn't slump this summer. How do you like that?
Is that big news or is that big not news because nobody's reporting it?
It's big news because almost every summer in July, the Dow Jones Industrial Average takes a slump right at the beginning of July, around July 4th holiday. And the reason for that is a lot of traders go on vacation. Well, a lot of traders went on vacation this year, and the Dow and the S&P 500 didn't drop. And then as we come into August is the worst month of the year historically for the stock market, and it continues to rise, and we are now fairly well into August, and the Dow just broke a record, and the S&P 500 is breaking records, and we're just steadily, slowly inching upward. That's significant. That means that something's going on that's different from what's gone on historically. Interest rates are still amazingly low. That's going on.
Right.
They're lower than they were at the beginning of the year. They're lower than they were a year ago. They're higher than they were a year ago, because a year ago they were 1 point something. But 2.3 range for the Treasury at this point in an economic expansion is very unusual.
Right.
But at the same time, we can also say some of the other news that we're talking about is very unusual, and that is that wages have not risen very much, even though we're at effectively full employment. So that gives us lots of things to talk about.
Right. I've got the S&P Dow Jones Indices has the – let me see if I can – put as many names as possible onto an index and see what people, I'm not the one that did it. S&P Dow Jones Indices, Real Estate, S&P CoreLogic, Case-Shiller. This is the real estate index concept where people are looking at the change in value over time in residential real estate. So looking across that year to date, you know, people say there's a boom going on in the real estate market. Well, it's only feels like a boom because it's the other side of the bust. Year to date, we're up about at the 10 city mark, about 3%, 20 city mark, about 6%. And it's probably closer to 6% across the nation, or 5.5% as far as what it was like a year ago versus today. So a year ago, roughly 5.5% appreciation in home values. And people are really excited about that. And the reason is 10 years ago, this is the 10 city number, and they just take 10 big cities, combine them, and say this is what's going on. For 10 years, the appreciation during that time period is down negative 0.28%. So that tells you something, and when people are looking at the housing market and they've just gotten into it, they feel like things are going really, really great, and well, it's still not fully recovered across a big swath of the nation from the downturn. So there's the overall, all of the nation together, when you combine everything, we're up 0.47% for a 10-year period. So the boom that's going on isn't as big a boom as we think. It's a recovery. And we're finally getting to that point. This is the big news, is that we're above what we were.
In the housing area, I mentioned this last week, but it's worth paying attention to because it's a major trend. And the big news this week, of course, was the employment report. But we'll talk about that in a minute. But there's an aspect of that employment report. It showed up down in the fine print of the employment report, but it was big when we looked at it last week, and that is that housing starts last month dropped 6.8% in the United States. That's residential housing starts. And we can't say, well, there was a blizzard or there was bad weather or anything, because it just isn't true. Why did housing starts drop? And the answer, apparently, is full employment and an absence of people who are willing to work outside in the hot summer sun,
right,
building houses, because the builders are saying, we have lots of people who want to buy houses, and we have lots of people who qualify for loans to buy houses, but we can't build enough houses to satisfy their need. And the other side of that coin is, during the construction bust, a lot of people who were working in the construction trades, for example, electricians and plumbers, left because there wasn't work and they went to do something else. And the way our system is set up in the United States is that first a person has to be educated in how to, for example, be an electrician and building a house. Then they have to work so many years as an apprentice and so many years as a journeyman under the supervision of a master electrician, and then they can go out and do it on their own. The problem with that system is, once you break down that ascension chain, where you don't have the assistance moving up the chain because we had a bust in the system, you don't have enough electricians, and there aren't enough electricians, there aren't enough plumbers. We mentioned in Denver and other places,
right,
apparently in Phoenix too. If you say, hey, I've got a serious electrical problem in my house here and I need an electrician, the answer is, we'll see you in 6 months to a year.
Right. And you may need new permitting to do even repairs. It's one of the,
right.
Part of the issue there, there's two sides to that. And what you're talking about is purely the labor side. And it's a very real issue. The other end of it is that there are now code standards across the country. So we've got a national standard for building that applies to a lot of areas that didn't have it apply before. And that means that where before you could have hired somebody that has done some electrical stuff before, if you're living in a big city, you're not allowed to hire and pay someone to do your electrical work unless they are an electrician. They're fully qualified to do what they're doing. Or you're not allowed to hire someone to come and fix your plumbing unless they're an actual plumber. And that puts even greater strain on the labor, which at some point we're going to come up with another way of looking at this. But right now, the inefficiency is going to cause a lot of people to get into the electrician and plumbing market as the price that they can charge goes up, and it's going up. I just got back from Denver and was talking to some folks there that had just had some different sets of things done. Electrical and plumbing work is appreciating far faster than home values. And that says something. It says that the inefficiency in the market is taking over. It means that more electricians or plumbers are going to be around, except we'll always have fewer than we need, so eventually robots are going to do it, and they're going to do it better. And I have to throw robots into every conversation. It's
obviously. Well, that leads me into something that I just read this week, which is completely off the subject of home building, except that it's not.
It's off the subject completely, except not,
you know,
at all.
One of the things, and we're not, by the way, nothing in this thing I'm about to say is to recommend you go out and buy Apple stock. I want to.
Apple's a bit overvalued at the moment.
You know, whether or sell your Apple stock, either one. But the point is that A lot of questions have been raised. Apple is making a tremendous amount of profit and not paying out a lot of dividends. And the question that has been raised, and I think raised appropriately, is what are they doing with all the money? And now we know what they're doing with all the money.
And their dividend yield is 1.6%.
Right.
I mean, that's not horrible.
But what they're doing with literally over $1 trillion in cash, they actually have – no, the company's only worth about $1 trillion. That's
no, they're not even – worth. They're not
okay, –
they're, no,
they've,
no, no,
they've got a tremendous amount of money.
They've got about $161 billion in short to long-term investments, which we've been calling cash.
Okay, so
– most of it's overseas.
I missed it, $161 billion.
There's a trillion zeros are –
well, it's,
you know,
the, maybe it's
nothing.
The total cash of the fangs that are sitting overseas.
That's
it.
That's
yeah.
it, yeah. That's all of those companies,
but
it's not really cash. It's just short-term investments.
They are investing in AI and virtual reality, and they think that's the next big thing. I mean, I think they may have some we may see a big surprise out of there one of these days.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, Facebook's got Oculus Rift. Microsoft is hilt deep going into its AR issues. It's happening everywhere.
It's augmented reality. Do
yes.
we have a call?
We do. Would you like to take the call?
Okay. Caller, you're on the air with the Person Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I had heard, I was in Dallas this week, and I heard something on the radio up there that they're projecting that house prices are going to, in the Dallas area, now this may not be everywhere, but they're going to have to increase by 30%. Because of the lack of undocumented workers that they used to employ at a much lower wage than you would someone who's documented or who's an American citizen. So I'd like to hear your comment on that if you have any comments. Thanks a lot.
We do.
Yes, we do. And while I wouldn't say it's as much as 30%, but it is definitely going to add to the cost of building houses.
There's more issue to it than that. There's absolutely a fact that there's a shortage of labor. Now, whether it's documented or undocumented, the point is, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Trump administration and some senators are moving to cut legal immigration by 50%. And the issue is, traditionally, in the history of the United States, home building has been one of the things that low-skilled workers come in from overseas or come in across the border legally or illegally, and they do a lot of work there. And we do have a labor shortage, and the price of houses would go up if that's the only thing we are figuring in. Like I said, home starts drop despite the fact more people want to buy houses. But there's another factor that is taking into account what you just mentioned. Takes into account one side of the equation. But the other side of the equation is how much house can somebody afford? And the banks are not, won't just give you a loan because you breathe today. So the banks look around at the price of existing houses, and they be very conservative, and they say, okay, we will loan you 80% of the price that kind of house is selling for today. So a rise of 30% means that it can happen, but it's going to happen only in communities where people have really impressive quantities of cash with which to buy the house.
What it does is it slows down the market. And here's some fundamental issues. Technology's changed a lot in the last 11 years. That's an understatement. 11 years ago, you did not have a smartphone in your pocket unless you were willing to fork out $1,500 and were the first one to get the iPhone. And that was a tiny little thing that actually did fit in your shirt pocket without stretching. So, and people thought that was amazing. That back then, remember, cell phones were valued on their size, and the smaller the better. Now they're valued on their size, and if the more like an iPad or umbrella, the better. So keep that in mind. Technology over that decade has changed tremendously. It's not just in the smartphone world. It's also in the construction world. When we were in this big construction boom, we did have a very large illegal alien population. And this is something that we were paying them. We were accepting them here. It was not It was very, very hard to not accept them if you ate at a restaurant, if you stayed at a hotel, if you lived in a house. At this point, because of the recession, we lost a huge chunk of that group. The ones that were single and sending all of their money back, and they were generally men, and they were generally in their late 40s. And they were the ones that were laying rock, and they were building the framework, and they were really good at construction. The recession hit. There were no more jobs. A lot of that demographic went home. Mm-hmm. The people that stayed that were illegal had other types of jobs and generally had a family that had started since they'd been there. So they had American citizens in the family. So they're not in construction. Now 10 years has passed. People that were in their late 50s are now in their late 50s, and they're a lot less likely to come here and work construction jobs when the economy of Mexico is doing fairly well. Mm-hmm. The economy of most of Latin America is actually okay, minus some extremities over in Venezuela. The concept that our cheap houses was built on the backs of illegal immigrants absolutely is true. We probably had a 30% or more discount to the price of houses in 2006 based on that. However, technology's come along and has shifted things around some more. The ability to work on site has gotten a lot easier. It used to be a big deal to take a table saw to a job site. I mean, they had table saws. They just weren't very good. Well, they're a lot better now. It used to be a big deal to have any kind. They called them radial arm saws back then. Now they're just chop saws. They're the normal thing, and you can cut very large pieces of wood with them. Nail guns have gotten better. And if you think back 10 or 15 years ago, you heard a lot of hammers at a construction zone. Well, now you hear these sharp one-time bangs as the nail guns are being used, and the nail guns have gotten better. So the ability to do more with less people, the productivity increase that we've seen in the construction world over that 10-year has been more than 30%. And that's a weird thing, but it's one of those areas where people have built houses since the recession. There has been construction work going on, and they've had to do more with less. So the productivity boost that we've gotten there has been really high. It hasn't been enough to get rid of the difference between legal and illegal work. It will get there. And the demand is going to be one of the big things that causes it to get there. It's a lot like the concept of fracking. When the prices stay up for a long time, we find a better way of doing the thing for cheaper. And when it comes to housing prices, I suspect we're going to, when you get into this, if there's a high demand for building houses, it's going to cost more to build than it did in our recent memories. So from that point, the caller's right. I don't believe it's a 30% difference. I don't believe that it's anywhere near that big. It's probably closer to 10 or 15%.
If we got, and I could say 30% difference, if the economy in the Dallas-Fort Worth area gets strong enough is strong enough.
And the boom is really starting there.
And
a lot of people from Manhattan going to Dallas right now.
And you have a lot of people who want to live in a restricted area of real estate. There's a couple of things you have to look at. One is, how much is the dirt worth? You know, like, for instance,
what's the value of the labor versus the value of the dirt?
In Austin, it's not the price of labor that drives the houses up. It's the price of the dirt, because people will buy a house and level it and build a new house on it, and it'll pay a tremendous amount of money. And they're not buying the house. They're just buying the lot.
The location.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and in California, it's the same thing. If the price of houses was driven up 30% right now by a change in the labor situation, I suspect we would see a complete revolution in the way we build houses. We would have more modular houses that are built in factories.
And that's already happening.
But we'd have a lot more modular houses.
Right.
And so you'd design a house, and the various rooms would be built in the factory, and they'd be hauled to the site and bolted together and put on a concrete foundation. So The absence of illegal immigration certainly has driven up the cost of houses, and right now, in this environment, has held down housing starts and the ability to buy a house. But I don't think it's going to drive the price of houses up that much, simply because we're the United States of America, and we get really innovative when prices get high.
This is another factor here, and this is an important factor. And unfortunately, it touches in the realm of politics, because politics is talking economics. We need more legal immigration. We need absolutely to regulate it and to stop the illegal side of it. But we need to look at what the demand actually is. Basically, if you're running a business and you say we need more help, you're going to do some due diligence to see where the help comes from. We should do that at the country level too. We can say, what is the actual need for immigration? And there's always that knee-jerk reaction of, well, we should be hiring local. Well, if you need a PhD electrical engineer.
PhD?
Right.
Oh, okay.
All the way out on that extreme, and there are people that, right, that need that, and they need, gotcha, them very, very much.
Right.
And the vast majority of graduates with a PhD in electrical engineering in the United States from American colleges were not born here
and
are not citizens.
And in many cases, by the way, this is another proposal that's in the Senate right now that the Trump administration supports.
Right.
We want to restrict their ability to stay here when they graduate.
Okay, so from an economic position, we bring them here, give them access to schools that we have made the best in the world,
mm-hmm,
limit the education of the people that live here so that they can't compete on an even playing field in an American college, and then force the graduates of the best schools in the world to go back home. That's a real issue, and we, mm-hmm, can go to the other extreme, from the extreme of education to the extreme of low skill. That's low skill's something that we can fix with technology. High skill, replacing the high skill, replacing the high,
yeah,
education, that's another issue completely. We need to look at what the demand is, and it's certainly easier to have cheap labor than it is to come up with a whole new technology and all the R&D that goes into that. Inventing fracking was not easy. If it was easy, everybody else in the world would be doing it too.
And fracking took a lot of labor out of construction,
sure,
and sent it to the oil field.
Because during the time period of the construction bust is when the fracking boom started,
mm-hmm,
and they had this tremendous pool of low-skilled work. Well,
right,
now that tremendous pool of low-skilled work is getting paid a lot of money, and they're getting higher and higher skilled. They're not going to come back to construction.
Right. And we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, they're not on the air.
They bailed on us. So what else went on? Well, we mentioned we were going to say that hiring picked up very nicely. The unemployment rate went from 4.4 to 4.3. It used to be 4.3, and basically it's hovering at that same level. We hired this is our first estimate, came out of the Labor Department, for July, was 209,000. But at the same time, they came out and adjusted their previous 2 months, and they increased the hiring significantly over the previous 2 months. Now, one of them they dropped a little bit, and the other one they raised a bunch. But that's neither here nor there. The point is, we only need to hire about 100,000, between 75 and 100,000 people right now every month to accommodate new entries into the labor market. That's people who graduate from school and they're teenagers, and then they maybe get a college degree or whatever, and they enter the labor market. So we need to do 75,000 to 100,000 a month to break even, but we just did 209, and our 24-month average right now is 187,000. So where's that extra, roughly, round figure, 100,000 people a month coming from? And the answer is there are people re-entering the job market who are not even on the
re-entering, or just entering
for
the first time.
Well, they're basically people, in most cases, who used to work weren't looking for a job, so they didn't come up on the statistical analysis of the underemployed or the marginally attached or whatever.
Right.
And they just simply made a decision, hey, my kids are in school or my kids have graduated or whatever decision they made. Or I've just finished school. I went back to school.
That's a big piece, right? Because so, if you look back at when the big push for going back to school was going on, it was in 2011,
mm-hmm.
which means that we should have a whole bunch of people coming back into the market over the past year and now.
You're using those complicated economic terms again.
Bunch,
yes.
Yeah, that's normally, I realize that's –
normally
usually
it's grapes or bananas.
Bananas, yeah. Grapes, water, not water.
The you could say that's
a bunch of water. Well, let's think about that for a moment.
You could bunch water up, but you need to freeze it first.
It keeps falling out.
The point is that we are getting this steady stream of people who are coming from an invisible pool, a dark pool. That's going to run out one of these days because we keep hiring more people than the Labor Department found in their previous survey were even looking for work. And the number of job openings continues to rise faster than the people we're hiring. So we originally, at some point, and I don't know when it's going to happen, economists think, oh, well, maybe next month, but I don't know. So at some point, we'll hit that magical spot where there are enough jobs not filled that people begin to hire, and it's, I think it may have already started, begin to hire from one, from you're stealing jobs from another company.
We're already really close to that. And this is something that's hitting the news right now. It's hitting the news right now, and people are talking about it, and it sounds like it's not related. The Nissan workers in Mississippi rejecting the United Auto Workers. Now, first we got to get some cultural stuff out of the way. People in the South are a lot more reluctant to join unions than people in the North, for a good reason, because it's been harder to get jobs here. And you don't say we're going to go on strike and you have nobody to replace
it. Well, wait a minute. My great-grandfather fought the union.
Could be that there's some kind of a correlation there. It's quite possible that the concept of union as a word isn't popular.
They're based up north. They're a bunch of Yankees.
Well, it's not just that.
And my great-grandfather fought a war against them.
Right. It's not just that. At the strongest point of the unions in the early 1970s, when they dominated everything, when it came to the auto world, yeah, you had the big auto manufacturers, but they had to hire union, and the state laws were changing up north. It was a union state, and you better use the union. It was a reaction to really corrupt measures that corporations were doing back in the 1920s all the way up through the 1960s of exploiting their workers. Well, the laws changed. The acts change, and unions overplayed their hand. They destroyed the companies that they were working for. Was there a good reason to have unions? Absolutely. And we can't forget that reason. But the union themselves, you know, when you're talking about a group of people getting together, what we think of it as a union today is there's one, not a whole lot of workers, two, the companies gouging them. Today, not a whole lot of workers means low supply, high demand, company's going to pay them mm-hmm. more because they've got a lot of competition. It isn't three auto facilities in one city. It's spread across the country, and there's a lot of competition for the workers. So when you're talking about Mississippi, one, deep South, there's that culture of self-reliance, and I'll negotiate my own way. Two, they're being paid really well. If you look at the pay scale of the people in the surrounding area, they're getting paid a lot more than their friends for working for Nissan. So when the United Auto Workers show up and say, you're being horribly mistreated by this company, it falls flat. There may be a group of people, a minority, about a third of them, that said, hey, maybe we could get more out of this deal if we just get together and say, hey, you better pay us more. But most people think they're getting a pretty fair deal there. And that's a statement about the labor market. If there were a lot more people out there waiting for that job, it would be even less likely that the auto workers union would take over because there's too much competition for the job. At this point, we're at that sweet spot. If we're not careful, we'll go into a place where you have to pay us more for doing the same amount of work is the norm. We're not there yet, but that's what's just popped up in the news. It's getting close.
The point is that if you have a great abundance of workers and a shortage of jobs, then employers are going to try to lowball the workers. That's natural market forces in play. And people are going to look at it and say, that's unfair. And then the unions
exactly. It's
create
kinda like
a monopoly.
If nobody wants to buy a house and you want to sell your house, you better sell it cheap. If everybody mm-hmm. wants to buy a house and you do too, well, you're going to get an expensive deal.
So the point is that when unions were at their greatest strength, we had an abundance of workers and a relative shortage of jobs. So in order to press their wages up and get things working in their directions, people had to band together and say, you're not paying us a living wage.
Right. We've got a dangerous job and you're not paying us for it.
So now we're in this position. We have a shortage of workers. Unions are not going to do very well. But the point is, we do have a shortage of workers, and we do need, both at the high and low ends, and we do right now need immigration reform. And the Senate did several years ago, passed a wonderful bill that I think would have worked out really, really well.
It's become much more political now.
And I don't think it would pass the Senate today, but I don't think it would pass the House.
Right.
And that's one of those things. And frankly, there is a concern. I don't think it will get through the Senate or through the House. Well, it might get through the House. There is a proposal to overhaul immigration reform, but basically what it does is it cuts.
Shut the door.
It basically says we're going to cut immigration by 50%. Here's the key that I think is important. If we want Social Security and Medicare to survive so that when people retire.
We need more younger workers.
We don't want to put ourselves in a position where we're using automation and robot to replace labor because automation and robots
don't pay taxes.
They don't pay Social Security taxes. They don't pay into Medicare. So if we allow more immigration into the United States legally,
let's
then
touch on
we
this.
Wind up with a better supported system.
Understand he said legally there. Let's talk about it from two extremes, the extreme of capitalism and the extreme of socialism. People go, that's socialism. Well, if you want Social Security, that's socialism. You just touched the socialism side. We need more younger workers. From the capitalist viewpoint, it's really expensive to come up with a completely new technology or even modify existing technology to do the job of a person. It's expensive. It takes a long time. It's cheaper to not have to do that. Once we do it, once we take that step, there's no going back and things get better for a long time mm-hmm. into the future. But there's a big front-end expense, and it means that front-end expense is not really going back into the same community bases. So you're going to see slums as the places that are being replaced. It's going to catch up and go the other direction. And let me give you a different example because that didn't make a whole lot of sense. Saudi Arabia has this huge and amazing infrastructure. There's beautiful facilities. All of their people get birth to death education as much as they want based on entitlements that are given to them from their government, from the revenue in oil. That's part of the reason why there's a lot of instability over there right now, because the oil prices have dropped enough based on what we're doing here with a new technology. Once we said the price is too high, too long, we built a new technology. Now we're talking about a complete shift over the next 5 to 15 years over the status of living in a whole swath of the world. The Northern Africa all the way through Southwest Asia. you're going to see chaos there. And we can have a little piece of that in lots of communities here if we don't transition slowly into that new technologies. From a capitalistic perspective, it costs a lot of money to replace that labor. From a socialist perspective, we don't have the taxes coming from robots replacing that labor. So if you look across the spectrum, low-cost labor is really important to the overall economy. Suddenly, we've got a party where groups of people on, you know, it's like the party positions in the Democrats and Republicans are shifting around into new positions where it's no longer about illegal immigration. It's no longer about stop the flood and reform. We need new workers, business on the Republican side. It's no longer about, from the Democrat side, let all the illegals in. The argument shifted. Now we're talking about something that should have been argued a decade ago when we had a horrible illegal alien population and there was a lot more crime associated with that than there is today. We need to be talking about the problem that exists today, which is prices will go up at hotels, at restaurants, and for houses, and everywhere else because of it, based on the fact that we don't have enough cheap labor and based on the fact that we don't have enough high-skilled labor.
And you need to get the cheap labor to 20, 30 years from now have the high-skilled labor.
Yeah, because exactly. It's their children. Kids. Yeah, it's their children. Kids. We want them here, too, to be better educated and so on. This is something – it's kind of like planting the shade tree.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look around at the time when you need the shade and say, okay, we should plant now even if we're not going to enjoy it. That's what's missing in the political world right now. We've got to look at the next few generations. How do we prepare the groundwork for better education, better employment opportunities, better training? You can just continue. We've got commercials to play.
We could very easily, folks, wind up in the position of Germany and Japan, where they have a nicely booming economy and they only let in people with high educations and high amounts of money, and their demographics are going to destroy their nation within 20 years. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we need to break for commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of comments and thoughts. Telephone number 773-1400. We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400 on the Personal Wealth Coach. And let's see what else is going on in the big, wide world.
I got to hit this cycle thing. It's really great. Wells Fargo's getting pummeled right now from scandal after scandal after scandal.
Oh, yeah. They cheated scandal. On veterans,
on auto insurance, on veteran loans, auto insurance, all kinds of sales abuses. It's just from one end to the other. You look at the practices of how Wells Fargo was doing business, and there's a lot of scandals. The reason why I wanted to hit it wasn't because of the scandals. It was because this is something we talked about 10 years ago. We talked about this in 2007 and 2008, about the companies that had the highest reputation during the collapse.
Yep.
And we joked about, give them 10 years, and they're going to be the scandal-ridden ones. This is the way it works. You get hubris. You get arrogant over being the best. The reason why Wells Fargo did well in the Great Recession is because it didn't make stupid sales practices. Well, what are all the scandals going on right now? It's stupid sales practices. They patted themselves so thoroughly on the back, considered themselves to be immune from the troubles of the rest of the financial world. And because they considered themselves to be immune to it, they got the very disease that was their anti. Another example would be Central Texas's real estate markets really didn't collapse that far in the recession. Well, that's because we had the dot-com bubble burst here, and Austin and Dallas cratered their real estate market when in 2000. So almost around a decade, 7 years before, and now we're looking at it as, you know, this is the great boom area. Well, it's the great boom area just because we didn't have a collapse.
So. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask you a question concerning gold. I just wanted to find out, you know, maybe you might know the answer to this. You know, way back in the biblical times or before then, how did people realize that gold was such a precious metal and it was worth something? And to the present now, what is it that they use gold for besides just making coins out of them or gold necklaces or whatever they make? You have a good day, sir. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Mostly what they do with gold is make gold necklaces.
Right. Necklaces, rings. There's some small amount of gold in electronics components. If you look at the amount of gold, it is less profitable to mine the gold in electrical components than to mine the mine tailings that are out there today from a new and existing mine. It's not profitable. It's a negative loss.
And in biblical times, gold was not the primary monetary. Most biblical exchanges were in kind. So many amount of grain or
right. The two.
I would say chickens, but they didn't have chickens.
No, it was in salt. It was in camels. It was in cattle. Right. It was in sheep. It was in cowrie shells.
And even the
Then incense.
And even the Roman Empire. Initially was using gold and silver, and then they realized that how unstable that was and how it would wreck the – I mean, they were smart enough to realize it would wreck their economy to be dependent upon a single precious metal. So they were using non-precious metals in their – just as we are in their coinage.
Base metals with a coating of precious.
Sometimes they did – later on, they even dropped the coating of precious.
Right. It was just the face of the emperor.
Mm-hmm. So – and that's what we have today. We have the face of presidents and so on our
and
coins.
And inventors. So Ben Franklin is not a president. He's kind of
But he set a lot of precedents.
He did set a lot of precedents.
Yes.
He was a shocking fellow.
Yes.
So
all those –
kites and so on.
All those – and so the idea that gold has intrinsic value is purely psychological. And
well,
unfortunately,
it's not – there's a truth. Let's not just say it's purely psychological. There's a truth to it in that the past has held a truism, a fact that gold is more precious than, say, copper.
Right.
Or
because there's less of it. And it has some characteristics to make jewelry out of, which means that rich people like to wear it.
Right. But the reality is that aluminum was only about 120 years ago far more valuable. It was the most precious metal on the planet. It was far more valuable than platinum. It was about 10 times the value of platinum by weight.
Yeah, but you have to say it right if you're going to go back that far.
Aluminium.
Yes.
Until we discovered that you could shock a bunch of ore with electricity and make a lot of aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought the cost down.
It
when
was
you're
that
talking about
guy.
Yeah, when you're talking about gold, platinum, the high cost items now, just remember that there are a lot of people planning on going up into the void of space to bring back asteroids worth huge amounts of money if the price doesn't come down. That kind of flooding of the market is going to occur. It's probably going to take place in the next 10 or 15 years, and maybe sooner, depending on how quickly they push these projects forward.
The gold is, I've heard it called a magnificent anachronism. The fact is that the price of gold is largely driven by people who buy it and sell it in India and China, not in the United States. And people who think it is a store of value, it's probably not.
All right. And just as a note there, the places that consider it to be a store of value, it was a store of value for maybe the last 150 years, and so they think that that means forever.
Mm-hmm.
If you look back further at these big disruptions in the economies of different places, gold, any precious metal, does not hold its value in a massive downturn. Food shelter, alcohol, those sorts of things, they hold value. Gold does not in that sort of situation. And we're about out of time for the first hour. That went really fast.
Yeah.
60 minutes of quickness. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the week locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You could read our philosophy, our newsletter, listen to podcasts of programs just like this one. You can email us directly, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. And we absolutely love it when listeners send that in. We use it so much on the air. Thank you, by the way, for those of you that have done that regularly in the past. You know who you are. All right, until next hour, this has been The Personal Walk.
Balance. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.